human beings have been contemplating the universe as long as there have been human beings. Broadly speaking, there are often variations of conclusions about what the universe means, if anything, and where it all came from, unless it has existed forever. But the variety of responses, according to C.S. Lewis, can be categorized generally as a materialist view and as a religious view. Lewis notes that the materialist view includes the idea that, quote, matter and space just happen to exist and have always existed. Nobody knows why. And that the matter, behaving in certain fixed ways, has just happened by a sort of fluke to produce creatures like ourselves who are able to think. By one chance in a thousand, something hit our sun and made it produce the planets. And by another thousandth chance, the chemicals necessary for life and the right temperature occurred on one of these planets. And so some of the matter on this earth came alive. And then, by a very long series of chances, the living creatures developed into things like us. End quote. Lewis goes on to observe that the religious view includes the sense that, quote, what is behind the universe is more like a mind than it is like anything else we know. That is to say, it is conscious and has purposes and prefers one thing to another. And on this view, it made the universe, partly for purposes we do not know, but partly, at any rate, in order to produce creatures like itself. I mean like itself to the extent of having minds, end quote. Lewis says that, quote, wherever there have been thinking men, both views turn up. And note this too, you cannot find out which view is the right one by science in the ordinary sense, end quote. And for centuries, the great thinkers of the Western philosophical tradition have comprised what are known as formal arguments in addressing these big questions. These arguments involve rigorous philosophical logic and reasoning, not in opposition to revealed truth found in Scripture, but as a complementary appeal to truth through our capacity to reason and think critically. Take, for example, our universe. Did it have a beginning? One way philosophers have argued that our universe did indeed have a beginning is through the example of time itself. Time is a familiar series of moments, seconds, minutes, hours, days, etc. But without a beginning of time, there is no time, for there cannot be an infinite, never-ending series of moments that has no beginning or no end. No clock, in other words, can have been ticking forever. Or consider the analogy of a train. As you sit at a railroad crossing and wait for a train to pass, you see a series of railroad cars going by, which at times do seem like there is no end to them. But we can reason that there cannot be an infinite set of railroad cars. If there were, many of us would still be sitting at the railroad crossing. We reason that the motion of the cars originates with the engines up front pulling the cars along, though we perhaps do not see them. Analogously, the same goes for the universe. What set it all in motion? There cannot finally be an infinite or endless series of physical causes that would explain our universe. Something or someone had to cause it. On this two-part episode of Apologetics Profile, we talk to Christian philosopher Dr. W. David Beck, Emeritus Professor of Philosophy at Liberty University, who examines in his latest book four fundamental philosophical arguments for God's existence, their history, and the objections to each of them. Here on part one, we discuss both the cosmological and teleological, or purpose and design arguments, for God's existence. On part two, we discuss the moral argument and offer you very practical advice about how these philosophical arguments can strengthen your faith and help give your witness to non-believers more richness, thoughtfulness, and depth. Dr. Beck's book is a wonderful resource for yourself, for your children or grandchildren away at college, or for your non-Christian friends and relatives. And as a special bonus, we will be giving away a few copies of Dr. Beck's book, Does God Exist? A History of Answers to the Question. Stay tuned to part two to find out more about how you can get a free copy. As we begin our discussion, Dr. Beck shares with us how many of his freshman students at Liberty are initially resistant to philosophy, and how he sees many Christians also afraid of philosophy. Dr. David Beck.
They've been ingrained with this idea that the use of reason, and especially philosophy and arguments, is somehow an affront to God, that we shouldn't do this. And I find that really troublesome. The most obvious point, I think, is that it's sort of self-contradictory. The very argument that we shouldn't use arguments about God is, of course, itself an argument. It is reasoning about God. So there's something contradictory about this point. And it's also true, I think, that Christians have been afraid of philosophy, especially in the 20th century. That was true because philosophy as a discipline was kind of taken over by the atheists. I know my father was really upset when I decided to become a philosophy major, because the only thing he knew about philosophy was that it was a bunch of atheists. That was largely true. By the 1950s, 60s, philosophy had, as a discipline, become entirely entrenched in atheism. But that just means it was high time for us to recapture the discipline. And we've done a relatively good job of doing that. When I was in philosophy, there were only a few Christians that we could look to, people like Alvin Plantinga and Arthur Holmes. But that has dramatically changed. And then I also think that Christians have a problem with the idea of faith. They think that somehow faith is something that is entirely not only divorced from reason, but in a sense kind of opposed to it. That if you started using arguments or reasoning about God, that would somehow negate faith. But I think that's just a misunderstanding of what faith really is. Faith is trust. It is commitment. The Greek word is a word that sort of signifies the kind of relationship that you have with your best friend, this kind of total openness and commitment to each other. And that, of course, has to be based on at least some level of reasoning, of knowing. I have to know some things before I'm going to commit myself to loyalty to anything, including my wife. I didn't just kind of pick her out of the blue. There were lots of things I knew about her. And increasingly needed to know about her before I was willing to stand at the altar and say, I pledge my faith. So faith in the proper sense is a commitment or trust that we have, and it's based on knowledge. There are some things that I need to know. I need to know that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him.
Yes, and so it's like Paul on the Areopagus on Mars Hill, where he's taking philosophy from a Christian right. perspective and reading the altars and the inscriptions and the poetry of his time and interpreting it in light of the Logos. And if all truth, you know, comes from the way, the truth, and the life, then you have something like the Book of Esther, where God's name isn't mentioned, but he's all over the place, that he is everywhere, permeates the text, even though his name is not specifically mentioned. And so you have this this wonderful philosophia, the love of wisdom. And I think the analogy with your spouse is excellent, because in a loving relationship, we don't abandon logic and reason. It's not, oh, I'm in love and there's no logic or reason behind it. It's like, if you're not practically, logically, rationally minded, the love's going to go away. that feeling, if you think that's what love is, it's going to diminish. But it's a wonderful, holistic approach to knowledge, that philosophy, as you said, the argument that we don't need philosophy is a philosophical argument. It's right. Somewhat ironic. So let's begin in the beginning, if you will. We have you begin your book with a wonderful compendium, and a hats off to you for condensing and taking all of this and putting it in a format. Dr. Habermas on the back has a finally exclamation point where you've got all this in one spot. It's like a convenience store of philosophical arguments, well written, very accessible. But you begin with the cosmological argument, which has been around as long as the cosmos, it seems, as long as we've been looking up into the sky and contemplating existence. So unpack that a little bit. What's the philosophical argument? What are the philosophical arguments for God from cosmology and the cosmos?
Well, this is simply, like all of the arguments, this simply begins with an observation that all of us make as human beings. The observation in this case is simply that there is a causal connectedness to the universe. Right now, I have some grandchildren staying with me, one of whom is just a little over a year old. She spends her day walking around, looking at things, touching them. We have a pinwheel out in the garden, and she's out there playing with it, making it stop, letting it go again. Psychologists call this creating a causal map. We do this from the time, basically from the time we're born, and actually well before we're born. We encounter, we observe, and we observe things in causal connections. Things do things because, and we're constantly learning the becauses. And eventually, we become real scientists about that, and we spend the rest of our lives as professionals learning more and more about the causal connections. It's what we do as human beings. And that, of course, creates a question for us. Now, wait a minute. How does all of this actually work? It has to start somewhere, right? So the obvious objection to the cosmological argument is to say, no, it just goes on to infinity. It's just infinitely complex in its causal connections. And so that's where we need to provide an answer. That's kind of the basic objection to this argument. But I think you can easily see why that doesn't work. If you keep postponing the beginning of the causality to infinity, then of course it never begins. That's like saying, I always use train examples for the cosmological argument. Suppose I come across a railroad crossing and there are boxcars rolling along, and all I can see is boxcar after boxcar after boxcar. Suppose I were to assume, well, there must just be infinite boxcars. Well, that just doesn't work. I don't know how many boxcars there are, and I don't need to know how many boxcars there are. The number is really quite irrelevant here as to how interconnected the universe is and how old it is and all the rest of that. All of that's really irrelevant to the philosophical question. What I do know is, at some point, there's a locomotive. There is something that has the capacity to cause without itself being caused. That's the cosmological argument.
Yes, and you distinguish in your book a difference between a abstract infinity with numbers, and sets and numbers, that we can imagine a number line going infinitely in both directions, in the negative and the positive.
Right.
But to translate that into physicality is the is where the impossibility comes in. There are lots of examples you give. William Lane Craig has been foremost in using Hilbert's Hotel, and there's so many others where you can't bring in an abstract infinity into the present. And so in your research, are you finding that people are, I have seen in a couple of places where people don't mind affirming the possibility of an actual physical infinite. Are there philosophers and atheists and skeptics who do at least affirm the possibility that you can have an actual infinite in physical reality as an objection to the cosmological argument?
Well, there have been attempts to do that, but all of them violate what you just mentioned, this basic distinction between mathematical idea existence. Of course, we can, in mathematics, talk about infinity, but there's a difference between our mathematical capacities to talk about infinity and there actually being infinite. And that's what this sort of rests on. We have to understand that there are no actual infinite things.
I find this question fascinating because you see a lot of emphasis on modern cosmology and the scientific discipline of modern cosmology being utilized in apologetic defenses for the first premise of the Kalam. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore it has a cause. So there's been a lot more science brought into the foray of this discussion of late, thanks in large in part to Bill Craig. What did people do, Dave, before the advent of our penchant for exactitude in the sciences as we have today? How was this first premise buttressed, you know, 1,000 years ago when it was first being utilized and then co-opted by the medievals? How did they defend the first premise? Because it must have been different than what we do today, because we're invoking physics, which they didn't have. Was it just obvious and intuitive to them that the universe began to exist?
Well, I think so. It follows from the very nature of the universe. This argument first comes up by Arabic Islamic philosophers, and for them, that there has to be a beginning of time is simply obvious from the fact that time and space are contingent. They are themselves the framework of causal connections. Mm-hmm. And you can't simply go back infinitely in time, or else there is no time. We can't be in the present at the end of an infinite process, because there is no end of an infinite process.
Right, right. The very fact of time itself is indicative that there was a beginning.
Right.
And so that seems to be pretty commonsensical, right? The idea that, well, we have time and now we know we have entropy. And so these combine in a very commonsensical idea that the universe began to exist. I know in a debate with Bill Craig at the Greer Heard Lectures in New Orleans several years ago, Sean Carroll had said this was an interesting tidbit in the Q&A, I think, where he told Bill, he said he found 12 or 13 eternal models of the cosmos in about a half hour Google search. But it struck me as interesting that there would be cosmologists in the 21st century positing the idea of eternality in scientific models for the origin of the universe or for the existence of the multiverse. Could you address that as an objection to this, the idea of the multiverse and why it doesn't work, why an eternal cosmos or an eternal multiverse or an infinite set of universes doesn't work as an objection to the cosmological argument?
Yeah, I had a graduate student who really got interested in the multiverse idea when it was first coming up, and he got me interested, so we did a number of papers together. I've got a quote in the book from Don Page, was Stephen Hawking's grad assistant, is now a professor of physics at Alberta. What he notes is that the multiverse doesn't really change anything. It becomes itself a kind of universe creator. So if you think about the history here, the first sort of attempt to provide a machine that would create the universe instead of God was evolution. What happens here is, you know, suppose I look at a brand new 2021 car and I note how incredibly sophisticated this is. It's got all kinds of computers and cameras and it can basically run itself, and it's absolutely incredible. And I say, wow, we've got some really sophisticated causers, builders of cars. And then you say, well, no, not really. It's all just the assembly line. The assembly line puts the cars together. Well, that's of course true, but notice it doesn't answer any questions. What happens then is, well, this is actually a multiverse. We've got lots of assembly lines, and what we have is some sort of assembly line generating machine. The multiverse functions as a universe creator. Well, that's interesting, and it may well be true. I don't know whether multiverse ideas are correct or not. Science hasn't quite clearly come down on this one. But if it's so, all we've done is taken one step further back. And so now we've got a machine that creates the machines that create the machines. Well, you still have to ask the same question. And it's not like you've somehow simplified it. You've actually made it more and more complex. So now I need some sort of intelligence that creates machines that are so intricate, so sophisticated, that they can create machines that will create machines.
Yes.
You haven't simplified anything. You haven't answered any questions at all.
No.
So Page concludes, well, okay, so God must really love the multiverse. It hasn't changed the discussion at all.
Right, right. And that's a wonderful segue into the next section of your book, sir, the idea of purpose. We talk about machines. There's, I know Sean Carroll and Max Tegmark have done a podcast together talking about the possibility of a matrix-like universe, that we're in some sort of hologram matrix mathematical simulation of some kind. But machine language in describing the universe implies the next section of your book, the teleology. When I make a machine, I make a machine for a purpose. I'm not going to look through a telescope to learn how to make a cake, right? That's the wrong purpose for that. I'm not going to make a very good cake with a telescope. So there's teleology in machine metaphor. Even if we talk about a machine of a multiverse or something like this, a mechanism of the universe or the laws of the universe, there seems to be an implied purposefulness in the cosmic fabric, that the universe, ourselves, everything else around us looks like it all has some kind of intrinsic purpose built into it. Can you unpack a little bit about the teleological arguments? Because I think this is this is the grandfather of what we would call fine-tuning of the universe. But it's a very old argument going all the way back, as you say, in your book. It has a long history. So unpack that a little bit, if you would.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if, in fact, this is the oldest of the arguments. It seems the most obvious. You know, we recognize this kind of design or purposiveness at very basic levels. Maybe the simplest form of this argument is Psalm 19, the heavens declare the handiwork of God. Well, there it is. The word declare is what indicates here that you have an argument. There is evidence that argues for a conclusion. The evidence is the heavens, and the conclusion is that it was handmade by God. So what is David talking about here? Well, I suspect he's got a lot of things in mind. For one, you have to remember that the heavens, the sun, the moon, the stars, were for these people the combination of a clock, a calendar, and a GPS system. It did everything for them. It told them where they were. It told them all this kind of stuff. So David here is not only seeing the beauty of the heavens, he's seeing the artistry, he's seeing the technology. All of that is right there evident for him. And he has to conclude that somebody intelligent put this together. This didn't just sort of happen by accident. This is clearly carefully designed. So I think maybe this is the most basic intuition that we have about the reality of God. Though, you know, again, the obvious objections here have to do, and by the way, a lot of these objections come from Christians as well. This argument certainly doesn't give us the God of the Bible. Well, wait a minute. If there is only one God, which God did you think this gave us? It's true, especially the teleological argument, that it doesn't tell us a whole lot about God. That's true. One of the most obvious things that's missing, if you want, in the conclusion of this argument is any idea of infinity. So we don't get any of those kinds of infinite attributes of God. You can't get omnipresence, you can't get omnipotence or omniscience or any of that stuff out of the teleological argument. But on the other hand, you do get creative intelligence out of this. You may not get infinite intelligence, but the intelligence that it would have taken to create this universe, or maybe even multiverse, is certainly really big. It's well beyond anything we can even begin to approach, even with all of our fancy computers networked. So, okay, there are a lot of things that this argument doesn't tell us about God, but it does clearly indicate that there is a very creative, highly intelligent source.
Well, and you could argue I'm a fan and a critic of Carl Sagan. He got me interested in the cosmos. But you could use the Sagan argument. He often said publicly and in his writing that the contemplation of the universe gives one a sense of reverence.
Yeah.
As well as awe. So he's pulling pulling reverence out of the stars. And, I always wanted to ask him, Dr. Sagan, where are you getting this reverential impulse from stargazing? It's just hydrogen and helium, after all, that you're looking at, really. But I think you're right that there's an intuitive sense. And in fact, it's Paul that quotes Psalm 19 when he's talking about the gospel in Romans 10:18. You know,
right.
The whole world has seen and heard and understood the inaudible speech of the cosmos, and so in that you see the characteristics of God, and certainly David did. Now, there's another David that you bring up who was not a fan of this argument. It wasn't, as some might say, more stringent atheists might say, a knockdown atheistic argument. Hume wasn't going that far with it, but he was not impressed with teleology or design in the cosmos. Can you unpack his objections to this?
I would put it this way. He mentions in his dialogues, actually the character Philo mentions. It's often assumed that Hume is just Philo, but I think that's clearly wrong. But in any case, we have these sort of standard objections to the argument. But what they amount to is to say that what you can't get out of this argument is the full-blown Christian God. There are plenty of places where Hume actually subscribes to a very mild form of the teleological argument, that as we observe the universe, we can certainly detect that there is an intelligence behind it. So you're right, David Hume was quite clearly not an atheist at all. Neither is Philo in the dialogues. In the dialogue itself, Philo clearly is not an atheist. But he points out to us that there is a lot that we cannot know about God. And I find Hume's objections actually rather interesting. One of the most interesting is that evil also has a source. This argument is often accused of what we call cherry picking, right? That what happens in this argument is that you simply pull out examples of design and good things, et cetera, in the universe, but you ignore all the bad things. And so you draw conclusions just from the good things and ignore the bad things. And there are a couple of things to be said about that, but one of them, I think, is that Hume is really quite right, interestingly enough. Hume gives us the only argument I know of in the entire history of philosophy for the reality of the source of evil, that there has to be a real intelligent source for evil. Evil events don't just happen in this world. They happen because evil people make them happen. The Holocaust didn't just sort of happen by accident. It happened by very intricate design. There's an incredible amount. I mean, it's horrible to have to say this, but there's an incredible amount of intelligent design that went into the Holocaust.
We hope you have enjoyed part one of our conversation with philosopher Dr. W. David Beck. And be sure to stay tuned next week for part two, where we will be giving you information on how you can get a free copy of Dr. Beck's latest book, Does God Exist? A History of Answers to the Questions. David will also be joining us live for an upcoming Atheist and Christian Book Club discussion. And you can join us too. Find out more about the club at atheistchristianbookclub.com. That's atheistchristianbookclub.com. Apologetics Profile is a production of Watchman Fellowship Incorporated, Arlington, Texas. For more information on our podcasts, cults, world religions, and other non-Christian ideologies, and more apologetics resources, visit watchman.org today. That's Watchman, M-A-N, .org. For Watchman Fellowship, I'm Staff Apologist Daniel Ray.